It was a critical period in American history. The gap between rich and poor was becoming greater. There was a perception that business interests dominated the political landscape and that money had corrupted the elected representatives. Congress was unresponsive to its constituencies, and the country was reeling in the wake of a devastating financial crisis. The parallels between the beginning of the 20th century and our current political landscape are stunning, and Michael Woolreich's new book, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics, tells the story of that remarkable era. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan and brings Michael Woolreich to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you.
Are the similarities to our time as pronounced as they appear at first glance?
There are a lot of parallels, and the more I delved into this era, the more I found.
And is that was that one of the inspirations for writing this book?
Well, I was thinking about writing it. It was around Occupy Wall Street, actually, and I was down there playing tourist and listening to the a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the anti-Wall Street, anti-bank rhetoric that was going on. And it was familiar to me from the progressive era. But, you know, there were a lot of kids down there. I felt like people had a very little sense of where these ideas and where this language came from. So I decided to write a history about the early progressive movement to educate Americans about why we have some of these ideas and why we have some of these institutions.
And why we're fighting them again.
Exactly.
To be fair, wasn't Teddy Roosevelt's era a much more corrupt time than ours is?
It was corrupt, but, you know, a lot of it was not in the local government, there was certainly a lot of bribery and a lot of bribery in the state governments.
People were purchasing votes in places like Rhode Island.
Exactly. People bought votes. People paid, you know, bribed delegates to win Senate elections.
And the party bosses were very powerful.
The party bosses were very powerful, much more so than today. They basically ran the show. They picked the candidates. But also the businessmen, the corporations were powerful because they provided the money that the political machines needed to get people elected.
At the time, U.S. senators weren't even elected by popular vote.
Exactly. Ever since when the Constitution was first created, they wanted to emulate the House of – the Founding Fathers wanted to emulate the House of Lords. They wanted a more respectable branch of Congress. And, we didn't have an aristocracy here. So what they did instead was they had state legislatures elect senators, thinking that they would be more responsible than the average voters. And that didn't change until the 17th Amendment in the 1916, I want to say.
And haven't some Tea Party activists campaign for repeal of the 17th Amendment?
That's one of the oddest of the Tea Party initiatives. Yeah, there was the lieutenant governor in Texas, actually, the candidate was backing that, supporting that before he backed down on it. And, you know, it's interesting because in some ways the Tea Party is very much like the early progressives, at least tactically, but the politics are directly opposite. So here you had, I'm writing about these progressive insurgents who were doing the same kind of things the Tea Party were doing, but they were, they were for the 17th Amendment. And here you have the Tea Party in some ways inheriting their tactics and strategies and ideas, but now actually going against many of the things they created, most notably the 17th Amendment.
Much of your book concerns the relationship between Teddy Roosevelt and Robert La Follette, both of whom were progressive reformers. Both Republicans?
Both Republicans.
But Roosevelt was born wealthy, and he didn't start off as a progressive.
He was always tended to be reform-minded, even early on when in New York. But he was
– When he was police commissioner?
When he was police commissioner, when he was even before that, when he was a legislator in Albany. It was a lot about civil service. It was a lot about corruption, and he was very pragmatic about it, very incrementalist. He wanted to take things slow.
We have a clip of Teddy Roosevelt addressing the Boys Progressive League in July 1913, way after the period we're talking about, but this still is pretty indicative of the way he thought. Let's take a listen.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically a square deal in matters social and industrial.
Was that the first time that the word deal was used? later, of course, his relative talked about the New Deal, and we've had a number of other deals since.
Well, he came up with a square deal during his presidency a number of years earlier. I think it was around 1905, 1906, when he came up with this square deal concept. In fact, the muckraker Lincoln Steffens said he coined the term and gave it to Roosevelt.
And we'll talk about Lincoln Steffen in a moment. But a listener writes in, Julie from Hastings, wondering why he is so often called a progressive when his foreign policy was anything but progressive.
Well, it stems definitely from his domestic politics. He was certainly on the imperialist interventionist side of U.S. history. But his domestic policies were progressive and became more so, especially after he left office as the president.
Wasn't he the first president to sue under the Sherman Antitrust Act? Now, I was surprised. John Sherman was an Ohio Republican. Did Republicans believe in expanding federal government powers in those days?
Most didn't. The Sherman Antitrust Act was actually targeted in part at the unions because it prevented unions as union associations as well as labor associations as well as corporate. Roosevelt and La Follette were among the early Republicans who did adopt progressive, pro-labor, big government ideas.
The Antitrust Act was enacted in 1890, but the first time it was used was by T.R. in 1904, 14 years later. It had been held up by the courts?
There had been some court issues, but it was mostly he used it in a way that nobody really expected him to do so. It had been used mainly against unions, not to break up a giant trust.
And who did he break up?
It was called the Northern Railroad Company. There were several investors, one of the biggest of which was the banker J.P. Morgan.
Mm-hmm. So there was a trust that had been put together by a number of different railroads. And why was that something that the president thought he should break up?
Well, it would have been the largest railroad company in the world if it had been allowed to stand. And, you know, railroads were so much, you know, they're just one means of transportation now. But back then, they were everything. You couldn't essentially ship anything or leave a city easily unless you were on the water, without going by railroad.
And he was successful in breaking it up?
He was successful.
Would we recognize the Democratic and Republican parties in your book as antecedents of the parties we know today?
By the end of the book, yes. So at the beginning of the book, the parties were very much divided. They both had conservative wings and progressive wings, although they didn't even use that kind of terminology there. They talked about radicals or populists or reformers. But by the end of the book, you started to get this shift as Bob La Follette's insurgency, which Roosevelt eventually embraced, tore the Republican Party apart and then split off famously to start the Bull Moose Party. And that pretty
officially
much
the Progressive Party.
Officially the Progressive Party, but everyone remembers it as Bull Moose.
But the differences seem to be less party partisan and more regional in those days. Well, you get the feeling it's the East against the rest of the country and maybe the West Coast having its own agenda.
Well, we still have a little of that these days.
Now it's also the South. And the South was weakened in those days.
The South was the heart of the Democrats, but the Democrats were weak. So, you know, through most of the 19th century, the differences were, in addition to the slavery issue and the race issue, the differences were largely regional. You had Democrats strong in the South and in the urban centers like New York, for example, and the Republicans were strong pretty much everywhere else.
Did the word progressive even exist until T.R. picked it up?
The word existed.
The word progressive did, but I mean in a political sense?
No, it wasn't used in this context, not in the United States. And it was actually not T.R., but Bob La Follette who popularized the term.
Now, this is also a time of reformist politics. Would the two have been used together?
Reform was used for a long time, even, you know, for decades, even before Roosevelt. And it was in around 1906, Bob La Follette started referring to a progressive movement. And by 1912, Roosevelt had called himself progressive. Wilson called himself progressive. Everyone was writing about the progressive movement, but that hadn't existed a few years earlier.
My guest is Michael Woolreich. His book, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael Woolreich, W-O-L-R-A-I-C-H. His book, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics, it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Other than the rise of Robert La Follette, was there a reason that Wisconsin figured so prominently in progressive politics?
The whole Midwest, actually, what we now call the Midwest, they just referred to at the West back then, from Kansas up into Minnesota, was all very – there was a lot of populism. A lot of this movement came out of the farmers who were concerned about East Coast elites and Wall Street.
But today, those areas, Kansas, Wisconsin, Missouri – they all seem to have moved in a very different direction.
Well, many of them are very divided. They actually have they have strong right wings, but they also have strong left wings. And you know what you're seeing a lot, especially even in this election, is there's a lot of populism going on both sides of the spectrum, especially in these states.
Wasn't there big business in Wisconsin?
There was. It was lumber and railroad were the big business that dominated the politics there.
Bob La Follette began his political career as a district attorney and then was elected to Congress. As a congressman, hadn't he been elected with the support of the political machine?
No, he fought the political machine, in fact. He rejected it and fought for years before he won the governor's race and started to dismantle the machine.
And he was elected as governor despite his opposition to the political machine?
Yes, he was a very eloquent speaker, and he would go out into the countryside where a lot of the machine bosses wouldn't go, and he would talk to people, and he would talk to them about what was going on and talk to them for hours, and they would listen spellbound. And he used his eloquence to develop a grassroots movement that ultimately defeated the bosses in Wisconsin.
He was less of a pragmatist than Teddy Roosevelt. He wanted what he wanted, and often that led to his bills being defeated.
Yes, this was all part of his strategy. He felt that in politics that half a loaf was not a good option. It just dulled the appetite. So he would fight for the full loaf every time, and often, you know, knowing that the bill would go down in flames. But then he would use it to his advantage. After the bills lost, he would go back out to the country. He would talk to people about the bills. He would read out the roll call, the names of everyone who voted against the bills, and he would use that, whether they were Republican or Democrat. And he would use that to galvanize people to vote against the people who opposed him.
What happened when he sought re-election for a third term?
Well, so that was the turning point. You know, for the first 4 years, there were still a lot of his opponents still in the Senate, and they thwarted his initiatives, and he refused to compromise, so not much happened. But in 1904, he renewed this campaign. He fought hard, and he basically destroyed the opposition opposed to him, and now he had a majority. And then he passed the full loaf, the reforms he really wanted to pass, the railroad regulation, direct elections that would keep people from bribing caucus delegates.
And you say that the split in the Wisconsin Republican Party that resulted from his third nomination as governor was unlike any that had preceded it.
Yes, people didn't really recognize the ideology. You know, they called him half-breed, as in half-Republican, but they didn't have the word progressive. They didn't have the split that is so familiar to us today.
He'd be called a rhino today.
exactly. They were stalwart. So, yeah, and he'd be the rhino, exactly.
What impact did this have on the National Republican Party?
Well, it was an oddity at first. You know, this was off in Wisconsin somewhere, some crazy state, some fringe, and no one, you know, there were a few people that saw it coming, saw that this was the harbinger of a much more dramatic change. But most people, it was just this, you know, radical politician that, you know, they weren't too concerned about.
Did it have an impact on Roosevelt's seeking of the nomination at the Republican convention. He had become president because he was vice president, and William McKinley had been assassinated. But was he popular during his first term?
Roosevelt was very popular. He's one of the most popular presidents we've ever had. But he was still worried about winning because he'd never really won an election of his own right. And he was worried about what was going on in Wisconsin. And he, even though he had shared some of the reform ideas with Bob La Follette, he didn't like La Follette's full loaf tactics. He was worried that the turmoil in Wisconsin would hurt his own chances in the state. And so when La Follette sought his help, Roosevelt rebuffed him.
How did the party leaders feel about Roosevelt's role in the breaking up Northern Securities?
They were not happy about it. So the party leaders in the Republican Party were very conservative, and they tolerated Roosevelt because he was popular and he could help the Republican Party. But they really frustrated a lot of his initiatives, and he would push a bill and they would say no, and then there would be some negotiation, and usually what they got was in the end what Roosevelt got was a much watered down bill that didn't really accomplish very much.
Where were the Democrats in all of this?
Democrats were a small minority. They really had no power. They had about a third of the Senate and the House.
Now, Roosevelt didn't go to his own convention. Was that not the tradition in those days?
It was looked down on. The president was supposed to be above politics. He was supposed to not worry about these things. But It was an obvious fiction. I mean, Roosevelt was listening by telegraph and telephone to his campaign manager, who was at the convention, and discussing strategy.
Another thing that seems similar to today, but maybe has been part of American politics for a long time, is the power of the House Speaker.
In fact, the House Speaker was even more powerful then. Uncle Joe Cannon, Joseph Gurney Cannon, was the most powerful House Speaker in American history. And he essentially shut down any dissent. You could not even speak on the House floor without his permission.
And you begin each one of your chapters with a quote from Uncle Joe.
He's great. He was this crotchety old guy with a great sense of humor. He was always swigging whiskey and smoking a cigar, and he had all these folksy. He was from Illinois and had grown up in a log cabin and wore his beard like Abraham Lincoln. So he was very folksy. He was very charming. Everyone liked him, but he was extremely conservative, and he did not allow any significant reform bills to pass the House.
La Follette decided to run for the Senate, and he won. How was he received?
He was, as you can imagine, the conservative Republican leadership tried to sideline him and marginalize him.
So they sat him in the back and gave him lousy committee assignments.
He was chairman of the committee to clean up the Potomac, which had some office in the basement behind a big furnace. And when he gave a speech, he gave his first speech in his first year, which was also he was challenging propriety there, gave a speech as a freshman, and all the other Republicans walked out en masse.
You mentioned Lincoln Steffens, and he got T.R. and La Follette together?
Yeah, so Lincoln Steffens was a journalist, and he had been friends with T.R. for many years. Back when T.R. was police commissioner in New York, Steffens had done the crime beat for one of the evening papers, but Steffens had recently discovered La Follette, and he was always looking for a hero, somebody who could help fix the problems in America, and he had really admired La Follette, and so they became friends. And Steffens, La Follette and Roosevelt didn't particularly like each other; they had very different approaches. But Steffens tried to mediate instead of a meeting between them.
This is at the time of the Muckrakers. Teddy Roosevelt came up with the term?
Yes, he meant it negatively, even though he was friends with Steffens and some of the other Muckrakers. He didn't mean to apply it to Steffens. He used this word to describe some of the people he saw as a little bit less of a more negative influence, people who were not as honest. But the term was picked up and applied to everyone, including Lincoln Steffens.
What was Roosevelt's reaction to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle?
He didn't like Sinclair. Sinclair was a socialist, and Roosevelt certainly hated socialists. He did appreciate what Sinclair had revealed about the meatpacking business. And in fact, after the book came out, Roosevelt launched his own investigation of the conditions in the meatpacking plants.
My guest is Michael Woolrich. His book, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. Another parallel with our time is that there was a financial panic in the early 20th century, and the banks were involved, but nobody was declared too big to fail.
Well, the government didn't get involved in those days. The government didn't have the power to prop up a bank or bail out a bank. And in fact, as that panic unrolled and the major banks in New York started to collapse, and in fact, New York City was on the verge of going bankrupt, there was no – the federal government lacked the power to step in. There was no Federal Reserve. And so it was the banker, J.P. Arpont Morgan, who in fact essentially played the role of the Federal Reserve and pooled funds from the other bankers to bail out the failing banks. So there were banks that were too big to fail, but it wasn't the government who bailed them out. It was Morgan.
But it did lead to a famous filibuster by Bob La Follette, which kind of reminds you of what happened in the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
My understanding is that Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the filibuster bit, was loosely based on La Follette, in fact.
And the Republicans beat La Follette on that one, but you say their victory was shallow.
Well, so in the same way that La Follette pushed his, refused to compromise, he knew these tactics he used to his advantage. So his filibuster broke Senate records, got a huge amount of attention, and people were telegraphing their senators, go help Bob La Follette, get in there. And it got people excited. It got people, they admired his fight. And it helped bring people to his cause and helped establish the progressive movement that was that point growing.
We have another clip of Teddy Roosevelt speaking, this time from 1912, about social and industrial justice.
As a people, we cannot afford to let any group of citizens or any individual citizen live or labor under conditions which are injurious to the common welfare. Industry, therefore, must submit to such public regulation as will make it a means of life and health, not of death or inefficiency. We must protect the crushable elements at the base of our present industrial structure. We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
So he's calling for more regulation of industry and a living wage.
Exactly. And income taxes.
Would he be called a Republican today?
Today, he would probably find a better fit in the Democratic Party. But keep in mind, this is 4 years after his presidency. He didn't push for most of these things while he was president.
Well, was he disappointed with what Taft was doing, his chosen successor?
He was disappointed, but really what Taft was doing was not all that much different from what Roosevelt had been doing when he was president. But Roosevelt, when he came back from had done this trip to Africa, and he came back to the United States, and he found it very different. At that point, the progressive movement had taken hold, and Roosevelt was a political animal. He wasn't calculating. He embodied what people wanted, what people believed in. And so his ideas started to change. And these radical ideas that La Follette had that he had previously rejected now seemed much more appealing to Roosevelt.
But he didn't promote living wage when he was president.
He may have mentioned it in 1908. I'm not sure. But he certainly didn't push any bills. There was no potential legislation for that. In fact, not for many years.
Did La Follette plan to run against Taft?
La Follette did. La Follette felt that Taft was vulnerable. He felt that there was a strong progressive component in the Republican Party, and he believed that he could lead that component. They were really the heart of the progressive movement, actually. It started spread from the Republicans to the Democrats.
But he didn't wind up running. Taft did. And then Teddy Roosevelt started a third party.
Well, La Follette did actually run. Oh. He ran for the nomination in the primaries, and he was fighting hard, but he was having trouble getting traction. And then
he had to get the party bosses on his side.
He had to. Well, he was trying to. There were no
Iowa caucuses in those days, were there?
Well, there were the caucuses were corrupt. Actually, it was the primaries. That was his brainchild, and the primaries were harder to corrupt. And he was winning in some primaries, but like in North Dakota, for example, and Wisconsin, of course. But then Roosevelt, who had been on the sidelines denying that he wanted to run for the race, all of a sudden decided, okay, he would go in. And he jumped into the race, much to LaFalt's chagrin, and just swept up all LaFalt's support.
Creating the progressive, or the, also called the Bull Moose Party. And how did that affect the election?
The Bull Moose Party did very well. It was the most successful third party presidential campaign in American history. But it wasn't enough to defeat Wilson. And in fact, you had a lot of split vote between the progressive Bull Moose Republicans and the conservative Republican Party.
So did this lead to the resurgence of the Democratic Party?
Yes. So essentially, the Democrats came, after having been out of power for a decade, and really pretty much ever since
Cleveland had been the last Democratic president.
Yes, and they really had been, for the most part, been the minority party for most of the time since the Civil War. And all of a sudden, they won the House in 1910, and then in 1912, just swept the House, the Senate, the presidency. The Republican machine had finally, after this insurgency by Bob LaFalt and then Roosevelt, the Republicans collapsed and the Democrats swept in.
And what happened to Bob LaFalt?
Bob LaFalt stayed a Republican. He never joined the Bull Moose Party. He believed that the way to change was to change the Republican Party, and he kept fighting for progressive causes within the Republican Party almost until he died. He ran for president in the 1920s and decided to run as a third party candidate.
Interestingly, Taft and LaFalt they had sons who also wound up in politics. Did they carry on their father's traditions?
Yes, very much so. So Bob Jr. was a progressive. Senator from Wisconsin up until McCarthy days.
And Taft was called Mr. Conservative or
something. Yeah, exactly. Robert Taft.
Michael Wilreich's book, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much.